Welcome to the Tech Talk Show, an hour of news, information and discussion. Well, welcome to the show. I'm Steve Griffiths and I'm here with Jay.
Hey, Steve.
How you doing?
Okay. Good, thank you. How are you?
And we've got a packed studio, actually. We've got co-producer Dan, who's sat at the bow. Shout out, Dan.
Hello.
Hi. And we've got producer Chris, who's coming up to a birthday tomorrow. And two great guests, actually. We've got Richard Rowley.
Cool. Hello.
Welcome, Richard. And you're from Fold Digital, and we're going to talk to you in a minute. And we've also got Tom. And Tom Cole, that's right, isn't it?
That's right, Steve.
And you're from Integrated Technology.
Yes, ITL for sure.
ITL,
yes.
Lovely. Yeah. And we're going to talk to you a little bit later on. So, news. It's actually a really quiet news week, isn't it?
It has been really dry.
Yeah.
Really
dry.
Yeah,
there's not a lot. So let's not bore us with, you know, making up stories or anything else. But I've got one, Jay.
Yep.
You do yours first. Go on, you can do yours.
Okay. Well, my one is that Toyota has launched a baby robot for companionship this week.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Which apparently is going to be the future of human interaction is actually with robots. I don't know if you've seen the TV show Humans.
I do, yeah. I've watched it.
You watched it. What
really
did you
great.
Think?
Yeah. I'd like one of those robots,
yeah.
please.
Well, this is a palm-sized robot that can hold conversations, and it's going to go on sale in Japan next year. It's about 4 inches high and has been developed to provide companionship, the company said. So apparently it can tailor conversations to include comments about journeys based on data from its owner's vehicle. It also has childlike attributes, but a robotics expert has said that it is not suitable for a child, and it's not a substitute for a child as well, apparently.
Well, it could be, really.
Well,
couldn't
it could
it?
Be.
A lot less trouble, probably, yeah. as well. Yeah. That's showing, though, computing power is increasing all the time, and it shows how this artificial intelligence and things like that are actually taking us, isn't it, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. Although, it does beg the question, why?
True.
Yeah. The first thing, why on earth
why
would
you
that?
Have it? Yeah.
But, like, you have to explore the boundaries, and eventually something of use will come out of these new, you know, these new areas.
Would you have one, Tom?
Would I have one? No, I've got 4 children. I'm happy with those.
Yeah. You definitely don't need another one. My bit of the news is really just a really good article I picked up on about Twitter Advanced Search. And I wasn't actually aware of the full details of Advanced Search, but really, really good for businesses, actually. If you want to find out, for instance, there is a geo search facility within Advanced Search. So if you wanted to look at companies in your area that are very active on social media, then you can actually use the Advanced Search to do that. So there is actually a button that you click to show your where you're based, and it'll come up. So
okay.
Do you use Twitter, Tom?
I think I'll leave that to Carl Lincoln to do that.
Oh, he's part of your team, is he?
He's in our marketing team.
Is he? Yeah. Richard, do you use Twitter much?
Yeah, absolutely. I think not to necessarily post much, but for research,
yeah,
it's just invaluable. I imagine you've used it...
We do a lot here, yeah. And as I say, we get a lot of things coming through for the show from various people via our Twitter.
Yeah.
We you know, LinkedIn or Twitter, what would you prefer? I think, you know, we discuss this every week, but we think Twitter's probably better.
For sure, yeah.
Yeah. There's other ways of searching. There's you can find interactions with other Twitter accounts by advanced searching from you to them. Click more options. You can save the searches that you want. Also, there's some really good ones about researching how to, and also marketing using the HTTP. So there's some really, really good. And also, you can search for buying signals, which are things like anyone recommend or any advice on. So if you put that into your advanced search, you'll know who's looking for advice on or recommendations on a particular product or a particular service.
Yeah, well, I think that's great just because it's so instant. You know, if you're looking for a recommendation, if you want up-to-date information, the first place you go is Twitter. So if you're out, you know, purchasing...
Yeah, you would. I would put... I'd put recommend me whatever it is, you know, the latest phone or, you know, it could be any service either.
The latest robot.
The latest robot. Right. Anyway, as I said, we have got a packed show. We've got a great pre-record that we're going to go to a little bit later on, which is about funding and different forms of funding that you can go to. So, but first of all, we're going to speak to Richard. So, Richard, Fold Digital. Tell us a little bit about Fold Digital, first of all.
Sure. So Fold's been going about 2 years. So, well, it'll be 2 years as of next week.
Okay.
So exciting that we've survived this long.
Well, it's a major achievement.
Yeah. So survival was objective one. Yeah. So what we do is we sort of help clients with their websites and try and help them value their websites. So sort of the reason that that we do this is sort of a lot of people have websites and it's sort of a key part of their digital strategy. But we sometimes feel it's a little bit sort of underloved. It's sort of a lot of attention goes to how people drive traffic to the website, but not necessarily understanding what you do with people once they're there and really how to value it.
Okay. So I assume you're not only giving advice about the content of the website, but also some of the recording and data that sits behind that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's sort of our solution is very much around sort of measurement and valuation. So it's sort of if you can't track it or measure it, it didn't really exist. So it's sort of making sure that's all in place is really important.
And what's your sort of what are the common mistakes you see from people around their web presence that you tend to sort of give advice on or deal with?
I think it's typically you've got a product or a suite of services that you're trying to promote. And it's sort of that disconnect between what the your audience is looking for and what you're selling. So they're looking for solutions and you're selling them the product. And it's trying to sort of shoehorn your product into what people are looking for. So traditionally people would have taken a brochure offline and bought it onto the website.
Yeah.
But people are looking for sort of solutions where the product is the answer. It's trying to shape that content to meet those needs and giving people the information they need to be able to do that.
And so a common mistake is actually just trying to describe too much and actually not thinking, am I right? And also not thinking about what's my actual customer come to the website for. And normally it's to cure a problem or seek a service. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. And especially if you're trying to drive incremental sales and traffic, then they don't necessarily know what the product is. So you're trying to sort of educate them and explain what the product is. So if they knew what your product was, they'd probably go direct. So these are people, the opportunities, people looking for a solution who don't know your product. So it's sort of, there's a bit of education that you have to do. So it's sort of, there are a few steps you have to take someone to before you present them with a product. Thinking you can put a product straight in front of someone and expecting them to sort of go through to sale is unlikely.
And obviously we see content, we see some websites that are just crammed full of content and it actually just turns you off visiting them really, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's sort of, it's less, I mean, I know we all talk about content in the round, but it's more the message rather than the medium. You can have one piece of content that meets the needs of that audience opposed to 100 that might not.
Yeah.
So I have some really interesting statistics here.
Okay.
So I don't know if you knew any of these, Steve.
Probably not. But do tell me.
So Google gets over 1 billion searches a month worldwide, and 57% of customers say they wouldn't recommend a business with a poorly designed mobile site, and 40% have turned to a competitor's site after a bad experience. So I'm really interested, Richard, why do you think that more companies aren't focusing on SEO?
I think SEO as a product and service that people sell has sort of changed over the last few years, and it perhaps has a bit of a bad name. Some people, the sort of the ambition of achieving a number one spot in Google, obviously a lot of people would like to do that, and I think some people have sort of preyed on that and made promises that they can't keep. The nature of the search results, not everybody can be number one.
Yeah.
So I think a few people have had their fingers burnt with what SEO was in the past. And because Google, and we're talking Google optimization really, so it's sort of Google changes all of the time. So when Google changes, you have to change your approach.
Yeah.
So, and what worked 3 years ago won't work today. So it does make it hard to keep up.
And how does it work with Google? Can you just buy your way to the top as such, or is it just more based on popularity? Like how do they work it out to be a top search?
Yeah, so I mean, well, yes and no. So Google do have paid ads. So across the top of the page, the first top, the top four listings will be ads that you can purchase. But after that is the organic search listing, which is where you really want to be because that gives you the credibility.
Right.
And the way Google determines the rankings is by looking at the number of links that comes into your website. So if you think of the internet as just being a series of links, every link is a vote. So if the BBC was to link through to your website, that would be, an awful lot of sort of authority being passed to your website.
Oh, right. So it's kind of like, it's like outsourcing in a way that you have to be popular with other sites in order to become popular within Google. I thought it was done by like page visits or something like that, that it would have originally worked from.
No. So Google doesn't know that information about you.
Right.
It's about how popular you are. yeah. And that popularity is determined by a link or even a social mention.
Right. Mm.
Tom, you've obviously got a web presence for your company, ITL, yeah?
We have. Fortunately, we've got a new guy that started with us 3 years ago now.
Right, okay.
Seems a lot shorter than that. But yeah. He's brought us into the 21st century with our website and tweeting and social media. I can say before that, you know, our website was okay, but it was very functional.
Yeah.
But now, you know, we're getting a lot more customers tweeting us now and following us. And it's bringing business in different ways. We have our own product range called the Vital Range.
Yeah.
And we're always promoting that. And that's been very successful for us globally.
How important is it to link into social media via your website? Is that something?
Well, it's extremely important. It's just you're trying to promote your service to an audience. So if you're trying to gain links and things in, the only way you can do that is by connecting it back to that audience.
Yeah.
You've got to give people a reason to sort of link through to you in social, which is harder said than done.
And we all see a presence is not just on a web, it's on a mobile device, it can be on a variety of other platforms. What are the common mistakes there? What should people be looking at if they're going to go across website to mobile device? What do they need to think of?
So it's sort of Google's guidelines around this area have changed over the last few years. So Google, I mean, ultimately, what we're trying to do is build your website the way Google likes it to be built. And what they want to see is one website that works across both devices.
Right.
So they want to be able to understand that it's a high authority website, regardless of which device. So where you've got one page that sort of degrades nicely and can be viewed on any platform is really what they're looking for. And anybody who isn't will be sort of penalized accordingly because they don't want to return a terrible experience in the search results.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Obviously... Tom's company, very much a multinational across various countries. What advice would you give someone who's maybe looking at website development and optimization across a range of different countries? Do you know, what would you suggest there?
I think, it does become harder with multi-markets because you've got language challenges. And here when we talk about SEO, we just talk about Google UK, but it's sort of because it's so dominant. But naturally, that does change by markets. And in China, you've got Baidu, which plays by a slightly different game. I think the thing to understand is understanding what people are searching for. The search engines do give you an indication of what people are searching for and the demand and the opportunity out there. And it's just about understanding what that is. So when you are creating your website, it does match with if there are 50,000 people searching for X, you've got content that relates back to that.
Yeah, that's good advice for me, actually, because we've got three separate websites at the moment, but we're focusing on the group of ITL now.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're combining all those websites into one, and then you can access through the one portal. So that's something that's being changed over the next few months. And, you know, we need to improve that side of it.
So our searches and habits, do they change by country? By great groups of countries? Is it slightly different way they interact?
Not necessarily, not in terms of sort of the... It's almost bigger than that because search is so instinctive and so quick that you don't even think about it. So it's more the cultural trends just sort of are replicated across search. So it's sort of... It's more macro things that happen.
And how do you then... So we've created a fantastic web presence. We've got content that's very much about focusing on services and trying to draw clients or customers in. How do we maintain that? Is it a common mistake that people don't update, refresh, renew, review their presence?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's sort of, you've got to think of it from Google's perspective. They want to be able to return the most relevant website for that result. A website that's been updated last week is more relevant than a website that was updated last month. So keeping that content fresh and relevant will always help you stay at the top of the search results.
And that will help as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
It does. That is another factor within search engine optimization is that actually when it was refreshed or when there's new information.
Definitely, yeah.
Okay.
Interesting. I just, before I came into the studio, one of our researchers upstairs told me that you won the 2008 Revolution Award when you were working at Barclays Bank. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
For the best finance campaign with Barclaycard.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a bit about that and how you came to win that award? And
sure. Yeah, no problem. It was a few years ago now.
Yeah.
But I still desperately cling on to it. It was so with Barclay Card, it's you're selling credit cards.
Yeah,
and it's sort of because people do trust Google implicitly. If you are number one for the term credit cards, then you're going to get the lion's share of the sales.
Yeah,
and it was about for them. They're a large business, and it's about making changes. And it's sort of trying to convince someone like Barclay Card to make a change to their website is a sort of a, you know, a 6 month job. And I think that the reason that we ended up getting the award was because we helped them sort of monetize, sort of helped them put a value on that internally as a business. And it was the way we sold it in, which gave us the flexibility. So it's sort of the bigger the client, the more ambitious they are, but the slower they are. And it's trying to sort of, you've got the scale to potentially do something quite exciting, but they're also slow. And it's trying to sort of get past that sort of in corporate inertia.
And that's a big problem, isn't it? Corporate inertia generally across the board.
Yeah, and I think with websites, it's one of those things that they sometimes sit across departments. It's the sort of thing that a company has, but nobody's really in charge of it or knows quite where it's going to sit, and can sometimes fall between the cracks.
Mm. So, okay, favourite website at the moment?
Favourite website at the moment? Ooh.
One you've helped develop, obviously.
Yeah, absolutely. Doing some work with the train line at the moment.
Okay.
So which sort is, of, yeah. I think if I wanted to buy a train ticket in a hurry, train I would line. Definitely use the train line.
I think we use that, don't we? Yeah, we do.
I think a lot of people do, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Again, that's about having the search facility embedded in the website and everything else, yeah?
Yeah, I think it's about speed. You know, it's a utility. You want to be able to sort of no fuss, be able to sort of quickly get to where you want to, well, as quickly as possible.
I think we had the news story on a few weeks ago about the developing an Uber-style app now for train ticket purchasing and things. So it registers exactly how long you're on the train for, and you can pay through your phone. And I can't remember which network it was.
I saw that as well. Yeah, but
yeah. Maybe you'll end up working on an app like that. So what's next for Fold Digital?
Well, I sort of there's only three of us. We've only been going 2 years, so it's sort of hopefully growth.
Yep.
We've got about 10 clients, and it's sort of now we feel like we're a little bit established. We've sort of got some great case studies under our belt, so it's sort of
and you survived that harsh first 2 year period, which is really rocky for most startup companies, isn't
it? Yeah, absolutely. So it's sort of. Yeah, I think it's probably the first time I've referred to it as a startup because you feel like a bit of a fraud in that time leading up to it, just because you're moving so quickly. And nothing ever feels real despite the amount of work you put in. So it's sort of, we're almost a proper business, and it's sort of now trying to grow, really.
Yeah, brilliant.
Is it a bit scary being a grown-up, though, running your own business sometimes?
Oh, absolutely.
It's hard, isn't it?
Yeah.
And nobody will prepare you for the sheer shock of you sit there with your fellow directors or work colleagues and it's actually all down to you three.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think it's quite a personal experience.
Yeah.
I didn't realise that it's all on you, and it's your personality really comes out. If you're good at something, great. If you're terrible at something, then the business will suffer.
Yeah.
So you've got to be able to sort of overcome some of your demons or some of the things you're not so great at.
And I think that's a really good tip about people running their own business, Richard, is actually knowing what you can do yourself and knowing what you need to go to somebody else to optimize. And whether it's a website or whether it's financial or marketing, it's knowing the skills you've got and bringing to your business.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
then
absolutely.
How to do that. Do you think that's true, Tom?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, we've got 100 staff at in Ashford at ITL, and you know, I've been there 25 years now, and you know all the families. There's quite a lot of responsibility to make sure you're keeping ahead of the game.
Yeah.
So we're always looking, you know, our order book is very strong. It's about 12 months, but we're always looking 2 years ahead.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're looking at expanding into different markets.
Yeah, because that is a different pressure when you start employing people as well and you've got a wage bill every month.
Oh,
that,
yeah, absolutely.
That focuses the mind as well. It certainly does, yeah.
I think it's that first hire. Having the confidence to know that you can sort of encourage someone to quit their job and come join you.
Yeah, for sure. That is a responsibility. It's been lovely to talk to you. I know you're going to stick with us.
So. Where can people find you, Richard?
Yeah, sorry.
The website. So the website is folddigital.co.uk.
Brilliant.
Cool.
And are you on Twitter as well?
Of course.
Yep. Yeah, nice. Folddigital, @folddigital.
Well, no, it's Richard_Rowley.
Great.
Okay. Thanks, Richard, thank you so much. Lovely to speak to you.
Cheers, thank you.
Interesting, thanks. It's that time.
It's that time, the best time of the show. So, Steve, it's come around again.
I'm so excited, yeah. As always.
So for any listeners wondering what we're talking about, so every week we have an unboxing segment on the show. Unboxing is where you get to hear real-life first impressions on products that our Tech Talk researchers, producer Chris, has sourced for us and from some of our special guests. We don't know what's in the box until we open it, and we make a decision alongside our guests whether it's back in the box or that rocks. Watch us on Periscope by clicking on the @TechTalkShow Twitter feed, and we'll answer any questions you may have. And Emily, our social media manager, who's just joined us. Hello, Emily.
Hello. Tech Talk Show UK.
Oh, sorry. I've got a script and everything. I need to keep up Thursday. Well, Emily's going to be reading out comments as we go as well. So if I just take off the lid of the
Here
box.
Here we go. So what have we got?
What have we got? We've got two phones, Samsung and a Huawei. I can never pronounce that right. So we have it's called an external battery quick charger.
Okay.
Useful.
That's looks, yeah. So
from a box perspective, it's been very simple. It's been kept very simple.
Yeah, it's quite a large box, actually.
It is quite light. It's quite heavy as well.
Right, okay.
So it's got a simple logo. It just explains it's a 15,000 mAh external battery quick charger, model PBT3.
Is it made by?
AUKey.com.
All right.
And it says it's quick charge 2.0. So if I crack into the box, if I can get the lid off. So then you go into a kind of plain brown simple box with OKey written on it. And then when you open up the box, you have the device, which is very heavy, and it's just simple and black. And then also within the box, you have a warranty card, an instruction manual.
Throw that away straight away.
Yeah, let's be honest.
Bother with the instructions.
and a charger as well. So,
what leads to that? That's a USB and micro USB. Yeah.
Yes, micro USB. And so, if I turn it on, if it comes on, yeah, it's on.
We need a
producer
phone.
Chris has taken the phones away from me.
Producer Chris. What phone is it? Samsung. That's not going to catch light, is it? <I'm sure. Do you see that one that had the battery repaired and now it caught light again?
So
yeah, apparently.
Right. No, I didn't hear that.
Yeah, it's a news article today.
There we go. Oh, there is some news this week then.
Yeah, but that's it. Again, it's like regurgitated news. So. Right.
So I'm just plugging the USB into the machine now.
Who other than me finds that their phone has just got no battery life at all? Tom, do you?
Well, certainly if you've been using your phone all day and then you're running to the evening,
it's gone.
You know, these battery chargers are quite useful.
Yeah. I find mine, particularly if I'm using anything running in the background, sat nav or whatever else, it just, you're lucky if you get an hour or two, probably. Is that right?
Yeah, well, I think we've just come to accept that it's the norm now.
Yeah. So,
so I've just plugged the phone in. That's right. Pretty simple.
So, yeah, you've done that.
Just like a charger. I mean, it wasn't too tough. I mean, even I got that. So it's just charging it up now.
So how quick do we think it could charge in? Does it say?
I'm just going to have a look now. Producer Chris, any answers?
We got the instruction book.
We've had to go. Bear with me.
Throw it away.
Charge the device. It doesn't.
No, I told you. Throw the instructions away. Yeah. Let's get it out and have a look.
I feel like, here comes Chris.
Here we go.
So what we're going to do today is with this battery charging unit, we have two dead phones, and with it we have a standard charger. For one of them, and we're going to use
a charge off. We're going to have a charge off.
Yeah,
oh, fantastic!
So, what we'll do is, if we just pass it around, we've had a question on through Twitter, and somebody wants to know: do you think this is portable for someone that doesn't have a bag? Would this pocket wise?
No. It weighs a ton.
It does weigh an absolute ton. I wouldn't go. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd definitely take your backpack with you. But yeah, okay. So we'll do that then. Should we come back at the end of the show and see how much they
So, cost? Just to run through, we've connected one phone to the portable little thing.
Yep.
And the other one's plugged in. I do think, though, we still need to know how much.
Mm.
So we can make a little informed decision a little bit later on. So, producer Chris, co-producer Dan, Emily, who knows how much?
Producer Chris.
He's got all the answers. Yeah. I think.
So this actual product was £11, which I think is pretty reasonable for what it does. It does advertise to charge 75% faster than your conventional charger, your plug-in. So only time will tell. We have both phones plugged in, and we'll reveal the results at the end of the show.
Okay.
Where can people buy it, Chris?
So the product is actually available on Amazon through Orkney themselves and through many other digital resellers.
And it's an Oakey, O-K-E.
A-U-K-E-Y .com. Okay. Yep, and it's called Qualcomm Quick Charge 2.0.
Right.
So, yeah, okay, well, we'll come back to the end and we'll decide whether it rocks or back in the box then.
Fantastic. Okay. Brilliant. Right, we're going to go to a pre-record.
We are.
Have you got the details?
Yes, I have. So it's Ruth Duncan from RNFBA. She's got some savvy business advice for us, so let's have a listen.
I'm joined by Ruth Duncan, and I know Ruth quite well, and she's a director of RNF Business Advisory. And Ruth performs a really, really important function because she is a licensed insolvency practitioner. You try saying that. And although we always talk about lots of successes in the tech arena, I'm afraid to say there are also quite some spectacular fails. And failure is very much part of any industry. And what I'd really like to do today is just understand why businesses fail. Also, if you're really struggling a little bit, what you should do and when you should do it, really importantly, so that you don't get yourself into trouble. And Ruth is really, really experienced. She's been a sort of licensed insolvency practitioner for, I'd like to say, a couple of decades, and she's going to frown at me for saying that, but it's true. So she has seen literally everything. So hi to you, Ruth. Can you tell me about why businesses fail?
Hi, Sue. Mostly businesses fail because there's not enough cash in the business for one reason or another. There are a huge amount of businesses that we see where the directors have just taken out the cash just to fund lifestyles.
That's interesting then. So I always think that people run out of cash because actually sometimes they grow very quickly and they're trying to pay for what's happening at the moment and they haven't quite got the money in from previous work, you know, and they can't get that cash through quick enough. But you're also saying, and I think that maybe some of these tech businesses are quite well funded at the moment and get a bit excited and start taking a bit of money out. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that is. I mean, you do have the traditional, you're starting up, you are trying to fund everything. You don't necessarily have the sales coming in to replenish so that you can keep going forward. Or sometimes you get too many sales, so you start overtrading and therefore the capacity and you get a logjam and you don't actually, whilst you've got the sales, you haven't actually got the cash because the customer hasn't paid you yet. So you've got sort of a couple of different issues with the overtrading. But yes, there are people who do get a little bit of, oh, we've got money in the bank, what can we spend it on now? And that tends not to be spending it on the liabilities of the company. But yeah.
Personal stuff.
You know, it's nice to have a nice new car and everything else. So yeah.
But it's still the same age-old problem, isn't it? And overtrading is a really interesting term in that you've got to look forward. You've got to look forward beyond the next month, beyond what's in your bank account at the moment. You've got to look forward 3, 4, 5, 6 months because you've got to understand what cash position you're going to be in. Because as you say, on paper, you could be making most amazing profit and you're going home each night going, "This is great, isn't it? We made X amount this month." But that doesn't mean to say you've got it in your bank account.
No, it doesn't. And cash flow is absolutely crucial, and obviously knowing about your cash flow, making sure you actually do have a proper budget in place, that you know where your profit line is, if you've got particular different parts of the business, which one is more profitable than the other. And you know, a 12-month cash flow is always a good start. It's not really worth the paper that it's written on, having just said that, because it's literally 2-3 months. That's the most crucial part.
As far as you can go ahead.
Yeah.
So it's a very, 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 very good business practice just to set yourself a budget, no matter how simple your business is, and then try and work out what cash positions you'll be in. That's to say, I've got my rent coming up in a few months. I've got this coming up. I've got this, you know, I've got salaries. Look at that, and then look at who has to pay you in order for that to happen. And you've got to chase people who owe you money. You can't just hope they're going to pay, are they? Because these days, unless you chase, they just won't pay you.
Exactly. I mean, we've just been doing some seminars around credit control. And that is the fundamental lifeblood, is who is doing your credit control. You don't have to have, you know, an accountant sitting in the office every single day. A decent bookkeeper, and then give that person the role of chasing up the money. And don't be afraid to put your customers on stop. If they're not paying you, stop supplying them.
Yeah. I think we all get harder as we are in business, because to start off with, you think, well, I can't upset that client because, you know, they haven't paid, and but, you know, they do owe me money, but I can't upset them. Once people haven't paid for quite a while, you do sort of toughen up a bit, don't you? And credit control, if you're going to employ a bookkeeper, somebody to do the books, make sure them chasing credit, you know, the people who owe you money, is part of their role.
Yeah, very much so. If you have someone who is dedicated, and you don't necessarily have to go in hard, you've got to weigh up the risk of, if I put them on stop, are they then going to stop buying from me? And it depends on what industry you are in. But if you have got someone who can speak quite softly, quite calmly to them, have a really good rapport, and just say, oh, come on, could you do me something this week? Could you just move it a little bit? The credit control people on the other side of your customer, they then will start, oh, actually, we get on quite well with us, and I'll go on, you know, make my director's weekend this weekend, give us something for Friday. They do then to start to move for you.
So what you're saying is they don't have to pay all of it at once, even if you just say, we'll do a little payment plan, you know, do me half or a quarter this week, and just try and make it as easy as possible for people to pay you.
Yeah, make it as easy as possible. You know, BACS, we, you know, PayPal, however, because I know the traditional cash method has gone, the checks are going. We still tend as a business to do more and more by BACS, but we still get a lot of checks in. Revenue and customs still only rebate by checks quite a lot of the time as well.
Yeah, but they are dinosaurs, so what can you do about that? So not having enough cash for whatever reason is one. Another reason that you're often seeing that people are failing?
Not having enough experience sometimes, and this sort of goes into another sort of theme, which is why we as an industry get slightly a bad name. There are so many unregulated people giving business advice, but getting some very, very good business advice is really quite helpful. And there's quite a lot of free advice out there. Princess Trust have got free, you can download business plans free of charge, so you can start working out your own business plan and your own budget and everything else. Chamber of Commerce's, they always do like a mentoring program for new businesses.
A lot of the tech hubs are running some really good seminars and stuff as well. So if you're based in a tech hub, you know, then, and they are giving those sorts of, you know, advice and seminars, you really should go to those, especially if they're free, I would say.
Yeah, if they're free, why spend money if it is out there and it's free and it's good?
I suppose I've got a bit of a bee in my bonnet, but I don't always think that management consultants are the best people often when you're in a very, very small business and you're setting up, and maybe in your late 20s, early 30s, and you've got your tech business. Just even if you can't get a management consultant, you don't have the money, get a mentor. Find somebody who's been there, who's done it, who's made all the mistakes. There's loads of people who want to help. But I do think somebody's background and what they've been through is important, rather than just Googling somebody.
Yes. Everyone can Google someone. I hate the ads when they're the top ones that hit. So I never, ever look at the ads. As you say, if you, like in the tech industry, if there are free places and free seminars to go and speak to them. You'll always meet someone else there who probably will give you a helping hand. Oh, have you tried thinking about doing this? Yeah, there's loads. And I know that, you know, they've got their own little, I'd like to say clubs, but that's not very techie, is it?
No,
but they've got their online forums that they go and talk to each other.
So I've got myself into a little bit of trouble for whatever reason, and things don't look good. And I have come across quite a lot of tech companies with some really great people in it who've actually got themselves into a little bit of a mess and have got really depressed about it. And, you know, it's really affected them personally. We don't want anybody to get into that situation, obviously. If you know things are not quite going right, what is the first thing that you should do?
You should seek professional help. And of course, you say, well, you would say that. Most licensed insolvency practitioners, we all give free advice. You can walk away, go and see another one. There's lots of advice shopping with insolvency practitioners. But do make sure you go and see a regulated one, not an unregulated one. We all give free advice. We will go through what are your assets, what are your liabilities, what is your cash flow. Do you actually have a fundamental underlying profitable business. You can take the advice, work on it. We will work with you sometimes, but then that starts to get a little bit into the pay us for doing it.
So essentially it's not like a lawyer's where they'll charge you as soon as you walk through the door. You know, it's like every 6 minutes costs goodness knows how much. But what you'll do is you're not necessarily going to say that they need to fold their company. That's not what you're there for, is it? You're there to really look at and see whether there is a proper business there and whether they've got a chance of success.
Yes, because if they've got a proper business, it might just be a little bit of financial planning, maybe someone holding their hand and doing a deal with a big creditor for some reason, doing that payment plan. You know, the other side of the coin works just for getting money in. It's the same way when you've got liabilities. Just holding your hand, if you put this plan in place, you can pay them off in 6 months' time. Yeah. Everything is back into, you know, back on kilter, yeah, back on track. And then you can work through progressing the company, getting more sales, building it up, etc.
So don't go too far into the abyss, I think is a real message, isn't it? If you're starting to get into trouble, go and see an insolvency practitioner if you think it's getting quite critical, and start to plan and start to find your way out of it. What happens if you know, dreadful thing to say, that actually there is no way that this business is going to work and actually you're in a bit of debt. How would your type of business then help?
There's a couple of ways, obviously, that things can be dealt with. If it is got to the critical stage where you actually need to implement an insolvency procedure, if there is an underlying business there, then voluntary arrangements are absolutely... I love voluntary arrangements. There's not enough company voluntary arrangements done.
What does that mean, Ruth, voluntary arrangements?
Everyone has contracts with all the businesses, so you will have a contract for your rates. We don't like to think of it in that term. It's just you've got the rates bill. You've got your landlord, you've got your suppliers, all those sorts of things. And what it does is it takes all of those contracts and mushes them into one big contract, which is called the voluntary arrangement. And creditors can't come out of that arrangement, but also the company can't come out of that arrangement. The company binds itself by saying, I am going to do these things. Out of that, the creditors will get paid either in full over a period of time or do a debt write-off. The creditors have to agree this plan. But once that plan's in place, the company can carry on trading. It then deals with the historic debt by the voluntary arrangement.
I see. So essentially what you do is you almost across the board look at all the contracts and all the commitments that company's made, and you really make sense of it and try and make a plan out of how you trade your way out of it, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. You carry on trading. You're still in control of your company, whereas the alternative, if there is no viable business still there and the directors are not able to put any funding in for whatever reason or can't attract a funding from anything else. And if you've got a viable business that's not working, voluntary arrangements. If you haven't got the viable business, there's no point putting money in. So, yes, you would then shut it down and put it into liquidation. So we then would come along and basically clear the mess up.
So if it isn't savable, so to speak, you would then manage all those debts, who's got to be paid, how much, you know, percentage of that would have to be paid, so that the person who's got themselves into that position can walk away knowing the bits that they have to pay and what their liabilities are.
Yes. I mean, we see so many directors who have got to the end of their tether, really. Yeah. They are completely and utterly stressed. They're not making proper business decisions anymore because they just can't see a way forward. So sometimes, unfortunately, closing the company is the only option. But yes, the directors then know that's the end of it. I don't have that stress anymore. Then the creditors are going to be written to and dealt with properly and effectively.
So this doesn't sound like a very happy topic, does it, really? But it's a very, very important topic. If you know that you're struggling, it's worth going to see an insolvency practitioner just so you can get some free advice to see if you have got a viable business there. Somebody really impartial, not your family and friends who are always going to say it's going to be okay, aren't they, probably? If you're struggling but you can actually get your way through it, then somebody like yourself, Ruth, and your team would put some arrangements in place so that you can pay in a structured way while you trade your way out of it, or alternatively, sadly, if there's no other choice, you will help them actually shut it down, get rid of that stress, and get it all sorted out.
Yes.
Yes, that's a good answer. Yes. So if anybody's obviously in this rather dreadful position, you do need to address it and you know, look it straight in the eye and get on with it. Ruth Duncan is a licensed insolvency practitioner, and if you're interested in her company and what they do, and there's lots of other licensed practitioners, but this particularly good one, rnfba.com is where you'll find them. And we're going to talk to Ruth in another programme, because this is quite an important topic. So thank you for all your advice today.
Thank you very much, Sue, for allowing me the opportunity. And we have lots of free advice on the website, and we have downloads as well, so that people can have a little bit more information.
Thank you very much.
I think that was really interesting. Talk a lot of the pre-record. We talked a lot about cash flow and actually managing money within a business and forecasting. We're joined by Tom Cole. Tom is from ITL. So first of all, Tom, I think kick it out. How does someone get from where you are to running a huge medical device, a medical testing company?
Well, good afternoon, Steve. It's a pleasure, and thank you for inviting me. It's a real pleasure working for ITL.
Yeah.
I started as an apprentice and electronics engineer. I love apprenticeships. I'm very pro apprenticeships, and we have an apprenticeship scheme going in our factory at the moment. Actually, I remember at 16, I designed my first valve amplifier.
Valve
amplifier.
What is that?
I know, what is that? Absolutely.
Diode valve.
Yeah.
It was replaced by transistors, and now...
It's replaced by very small components. You can get 10 components on the size of a pinhead nowadays.
Yeah.
And
Alan Turing was one that used it, didn't he? And his
absolutely. Yeah, so I've always been interested in electronics. And then I moved into medical electronics when I joined a company called Coulter Electronics. They're now called Beckman Coulter. They're one of the biggest medical device companies in the world. So my background's always been electronics and manufacturing. And I love making things.
Yep.
I don't make the things now. My staff do, and they do a very good job doing it.
Yeah.
They make quality medical devices for the world.
Right.
You know, we've got 100 staff in Ashford, and we've got 25 design engineers. So we take your idea from concept all the way through prototyping, full-scale manufacturing, and then we help you with distribution in a different market.
And we, obviously, within a very regulated and structured market, obviously the medical market, there must be a considerable time lag between a possible idea for a new test for a form of cancer, for instance, and actually taking it from the theory and getting it to market must be quite a long period of time, isn't it?
It's not easy to get into the medical industry, and you know, we've got a wealth of knowledge. We've got a whole team that looks after regulatory affairs.
Right.
A chap called Andy Goodenough, who does an exceptionally good job. He does lecturing on the subject as well. So taking from concept all the way through to clinical trials, the design generally takes about 12 or 14 months. The clinical trials can take another 12 months. So to get to market, you're looking at least 2 years.
And is it a question of constant innovation? Obviously not standing still at all. Is that something that your company is always going to be...
Yeah, I mean, my engineers just love working on different projects. You know, they're working on a breast scanner 1 year, and then cervical cancer the next year. You know, they've got all sorts of top secret projects they're working on now that I can't tell you about.
No.
I'll probably have to shoot you afterwards.
That's so. Okay. Yeah. Well, you can probably, hopefully, you'll be able to treat me if you shoot me. But yeah.
So, yeah, they love working on technology, and they thrive in those areas.
Is it important to lock your IP down, i.e. in terms of that? Do you spend a lot of time and focus on that as well?
Well, believe it or not, one of our biggest selling points is not to collect the IP, because the IP belongs to our customers. So we're happy to design something for them.
Mm-hmm.
As long as they pay us in good time,
yep.
They receive all the IP, all the drawings, all the circuit diagrams, all the firmware, software, industrial design, everything.
Is that unusual in your industry, or is that something?
It actually makes the relationship a lot easier.
I can imagine. Actually.
Some of our competitors try and collect little bits of IP.
Yep. And then they're obviously getting a licensing type model where they're looking at income that way.
Yeah, and they do that, but sometimes they get in problems with their customers. And we make it quite clear cut that come to us, you know, we won't pinch your IP, but we've got some great ideas. The best thing about our company is the know-how of the engineers, and it's all about know-how.
And you had an apprenticeship scheme. Do you see that as a really important way to bring talent through as well?
Yeah, we've just taken on two new apprentices. Yeah. One called Dan and one called Andrew.
Right. Okay.
One of them's working on biochemistry.
Yeah.
Started his college course a couple of weeks ago, and the other one wants to be a systems engineer.
Okay.
And, you know, we desperately need people like that to come up through the ranks. You know, the company's been going for 40 years now.
Yeah.
We've got our anniversary in February next year at Lim Castle. We've got a big party going on.
Oh,
so
that's brilliant.
I think that's where producer Chris is having his birthday.
I think he doesn't he live there?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
I think he might own the West Wing of it. Yeah, great to celebrate 40 years in business, though, and
it is.
I mean, the changes you must have seen over 40 years or the 25 years I know you've been there, changes in the market and what you do, has that changed a lot?
There's a lot of change in the technology, obviously.
Yeah.
There's a lot of change in the market. You've got to be driving the company ahead all the time. You've got to be looking for new markets. We set up in China 8 years ago. We set up there for low-volume manufacturing. Low cost, but now it's becoming a fantastic sales opportunity for us for our own product
range. And having that presence in China in terms of production has helped you actually gain access to their markets, hasn't it?
It is, absolutely. We're now selling back to the Chinese people. They love European goods. They love UK designs. There's a middle class wealth of people coming through. And they want to be treated with the latest technology.
So a bigger market than America or of a similar size in terms
of... At the moment, America is our biggest market.
Right.
But China is certainly catching up. And we don't want to lose any opportunities there. I'm trying at the moment to get our first R&D design project from China.
So they'll design it for you?
We will design it in the UK
for
a very large Chinese company.
Okay.
And we've never done that before, and that's something new for us.
And then the Chinese company will have the intellectual rights?
The intellectual rights, but we will probably get the manufacturing, and it'll be manufactured in our factory in Shanghai.
Brilliant. And a lot of lessons learned when setting up the business in China?
Yeah, there was. Yeah, 8 years ago, we had an order for 500 systems and our customer wanted the product made in China. But unfortunately, we had no registration, we had no staff, no factory, no general manager.
Yeah.
So it did focus our attention to make things happen.
Yeah.
And with 8 months, we were producing and delivering goods.
So I mean, that's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think that's an amazing achievement to do that. So to have that all in one place. Are there any markets where you'd like to go to? Any countries or areas?
Well, we're expanding. We're in the US now at the moment. We've got a service center in Virginia. We've been there 3 years.
Any reason why Virginia, or it's just...
Yeah, Virginia, very nice people.
Yeah.
They gave us a soft landing in terms of they helped us there.
Yeah.
They helped with some of the financing. They helped find us customers.
Oh, that's good.
Suppliers, because obviously we need a supply chain in that area as well.
Yep.
We looked at other places like Boston. They're a little bit more hard-nosed. And we said, well, we need a service center in the center of America on the East Coast. And Virginia was the best option for us.
Yeah, because there was a link between Kent and that area for a while, wasn't there? Do you remember that?
There still is a link. There still is a link.
What's the link?
It's through the councils.
Yeah, Kent County Council had a bit of a trade and educational sort of partnership information sharing, I think.
That still goes on.
There used to be direct flights out of Manston, didn't
there?
That's
right,
I think. Was it once a week or something? I can't remember now.
Yeah, so
it was all
not now.
Shut, obviously. Yeah, it's going to be houses or something. So in terms of lessons learned in business, it's really it's good to talk to people who have different experiences. What would you do differently if you were looking to go to another market in terms of country or sell your products or make a link?
It's all about the quality of the design of the product. If you've got a good product and a good service, then Brexit won't make a difference.
No.
We're making complex medical devices. We've got a customer in France that will be placing more orders next year.
Yeah.
They're not going to stop doing that.
No, it's about how the framework around it is managed.
But absolutely.
That market the need will always be there.
Yeah, and there'll always be a need for good medical devices and medical instrumentation and diagnostics.
Yeah.
We're all looking to be treated quicker these days. We want to go for a blood test. We want a result in 10 minutes.
There's also this move to more self-test as well, isn't there?
There's a big move for point-of-care diagnostics,
yep.
Which is having a small piece of kit the size of a laptop in the doctor's office. He takes a small prick of blood and you get a result within 10 or 12 minutes.
Yeah.
And then it will drive back to the home market from there.
Yeah, because that's another area we see is about this home, either home diagnostic or home interaction with other medical professionals. I mean, one company we work with was about heart monitoring, remote heart monitoring and biorhythms during the day, and a very clever software that they use to transfer the information. Do you see that continuing, that trend as well?
Absolutely. That's one of the areas that we're looking in for the future. We're looking in at sensors and wearable sensors to detect early signs of heart attacks, for instance. We're always looking ahead. We're working with the UCL College of London.
Mm-hmm.
We're sponsored 2 PhD students. They're working on 2 very novel medical devices.
Right.
They're in their second year of PhD at the moment. And in 4 years' time, we hope to receive, and take it commercially into the market.
Wow. Yeah. Do people say to you, enough, can we just stop doing new stuff and carry on? Or is it?
It is so exciting to work for the company. I am the MD and I'm part owner, but I love working for ITL.
Yeah.
It's just a pleasure to work with very clever engineers and scientists.
Yeah.
No,
it comes across as well. You're obviously clearly really passionate about your company.
Every day must be different.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah. And also to have a business owner who sat there going, look, I'm not actually worried about Brexit because I've got enough confidence in my product, in my team, and in our creativity, that it whatever barriers are there, we will overcome them anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. Innovation's all about teamwork. It's about the group of engineers and production technicians that produce good quality work.
Yeah.
Down to the cleaners that keep the factory clean.
Yeah.
Down to the receptionist that greets all the customers coming through the door.
Mm-hmm.
I would love you to come to ITL and hope that you feel that same experience.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sure I do. And is that the key to keep the innovation going?
The key is we're like one big family, and I'd like to say a happy family. We have a bit of fun on the way.
Yeah.
And we, it's an exciting place to work.
Yeah.
You don't get the opportunities at other places to work on so many different technologies.
Yeah, and also some things that actually can really make a difference. And I think people see that, don't they?
Yeah, you're saving lives and, what a great pleasure that is.
Yeah.
You're finding cancer early.
Mm. God, it's fantastic, yeah. So what about linking in with other organisations? What about charities like, obviously, cancer research and things like that? Are you heavily involved in some of those areas?
Yeah, we do a lot for charity.
Really?
We recently had a golf day, an ITL golf day.
Okay.
And, we sponsored a breast cancer charity for that.
That's really good.
And we collected quite a lot of money in that situation. So we're always doing charity walks, runs, cycling, all those type of things.
Yeah. Oh, great. Well, we could have talked for ages. Tell us, how do we get hold of your company and where can we get more information about ITL?
Well, you can find us on the website. It's itl.co.uk.
Yep.
You can tweet us as well.
Yeah, I'm actually, you've been tweeting your... your guy's been tweeting away as we've been sitting here speaking, actually.
Okay, and we're also we're in Germany, Dusseldorf, in November, at the biggest medical show in the world.
Yes.
Which is called Medica.
Yeah.
And it's in we're in Hall 3, stand H20.
Okay. Also, your social media person has actually put a really good link up to your latest article on wearable medical devices. So that's on your
I'm thinking a tech talk show trip to Germany, Steve. What do you think?
Yeah, I think maybe we'll take the show there.
Yeah, live.
We'll take the show. Yeah, it's a really good article, actually. I'm just scanning through it as we speak about heart rate, sleep quality, wearables in med tech. Well, it's really interesting, actually. And that's on your website under News and Resources. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, great.
I hope you see the product in a couple of years.
Yeah, yeah, anything and to assist with, you know. I think the people are far better if they can remain in their own homes as long as possible, regardless of what medical issues they've got, because actually it's actually quality of life for them, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's great.
Yeah.
Tom, lovely to meet you. And it's lovely to see somebody so passionate about what they do. Yeah. It's been fantastic. So I think we're just going to round up.
Before we go, we have producer Chris with the results.
So the results of the Super Speedy battery tester is...
So for the portable device, in the how long have we been on? Probably 25 minutes of it being plugged in, we've actually gained 50% battery charge. So for a short trip on the bus, train journey, that's going to be beneficial.
Against plugged in one though.
Yep, the standard charger over the time has only managed to reach a measly 20%.
So, two and a half times better. So would we buy one?
No.
And why not?
Because it's too heavy.
Yeah,
couldn't be bothered to lug that around. And £11. Mm.
Tom?
Yeah, I agree. I've actually bought a smaller one. So
okay. Yeah. Richard?
Yeah, I think a smaller one, definitely.
Yeah. I like the idea of the quick charge. Yeah. I think, you know, to get 50% in literally 20 minutes or so has been great. So I think...
Back in the box for me.
Back in the box. Back in the box for Tom.
Yeah.
Back in the box. And that's solely around the weight and size of what we've got.
It's too heavy for people to carry, I think.
Definitely, yeah. So, I think we're coming to the end of the show.
We are. I just want to say that thank you for everyone who has been tuning in. But please get in touch via our Twitter handle, the @TechTalkShowUK. Got it right this time. And our website, thetechtalkshow.co.uk. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to hear your opinions on anything we've spoken about today.
Yeah.
We also want to say a big thank you to our guests, Richard and Tom.
Thank you very much, Richard. Where do we get hold of you?
At folddigital.co.uk.
Folddigital.co.uk. And also on your Twitter. Tom, we've got your website at
itl.co.uk.
Brilliant.
And Twitter as well.
And there's some great information. I'm scanning through your website now, actually. There's some really great information there.
And I'm booking flights to Germany.
Where was it?
Hamburg, yeah.
thanks for joining us. It's been great. Thank you very much.
Cool. Cheers.
Thank you.
Cheers.